What Freud may have missed here or not written about is that the investment in the lost object is a much more reconstructive and integrative process, where we, for instance, remember all the stories that we have heard from the lost object, the repetitive stories, for instance, about the childhood of the person or how they met significant others, etc. And all these stories are within us and revived, and we have questions. We think, too bad, I never asked about this or that. And in activating these memories, we also experience joy, and we have a slow process of integration, which is not necessarily so much about loss, but about how continues this person to live in our minds. And that is a little bit the focus of this novel. It's in that sense a portrait of the mind and the process of mourning.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Cordelia Schmidt-Hellerow. Dr. Schmidt-Hellerow is a training and supervising analyst and is on the faculty of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society. She is both an analyst and also a novelist, and she has written three novels, the latest of which will be the focus of our attention today. And it's called Memento, a novel in dreams, thoughts, and images. And as you will hear in our discussion, this is an unusual novel in the sense that it invites the reader to immerse themselves in ambiguity and confusion and uncertainty, almost in a dreamlike state. And she feels that this is the best way to give the reader a sense of what mourning is like, what mourning is like when the past and the present memories and resentments and affections all come together. And she has the courage and facility to put this on paper. It's sort of like a painter or a composer. She really invites us to get to know the experience. We discuss that, and we also discuss some of her clinical work. She is well known as a theoretician in psychoanalysis, and she introduces the concept of lethe, L-E-T-H-E, which is from the Greek mythology. It is a river in the underworld of Hades that causes people to forget their past if they drink from it. And she sets that apart from libido. And she spends some time clarifying that for us, and makes a clear point, a very clinically relevant point, it seems to me, that the notion of aggression being bedrock, it doesn't match her clinical experience, that aggression is at the beginning of a story, hardly the end of it, that there's always a context and a meaning yet to be unpacked when a patient is struggling with aggression. She also very generously shares with us her childhood story. When I asked her about what brings her to be this kind of analyst, she shares the story about how exacting she tried to be to please her father with what she knew, and how that exacting has stayed with her over the course of her life, and has remained a source of pleasure. And as I point out, it is both a pleasure for her and also for the many of us who continue to learn from her. Here is my conversation with Cordelia. Thank you. Cordelia, welcome back to the podcast. It's good to have you here again. Cordelia, you are a psychoanalytic clinician, a theoretician, and a novelist. And for the many who know you, we have a sense that these creative expressions of yours come from a deep-seated and indeed passionately held fascination with how the mind works, curiosity about it, and that all these efforts are your ways of coming to terms with this curiosity and the things you discover and the enthusiasm that you bring to these discoveries and your wish to share it with the many who learn from you. And today we're going to talk about three of your areas, which is your fiction writing, your clinical work, and your theorizing. It's well known that you're the chair of the IPA and Culture Committee, but we're going to put that aside for the moment. We're going to start with your book, your latest novel called Memento. The full title is Memento, A Novel in Dreams, Thoughts, and Images. And I want to share with you my experience of reading the novel. It's a special experience. It's not a usual novel that has a storyline that you can pick up at any point and know exactly where you are. It reminded me at times of the analytic couch, on either side of it, if you will, where there are times where you're not sure of reality. You don't know if you're speaking in a dream or out of a dream, if time is present or past, and if this person you're speaking about and with is here or there. And the best description for this book came from one of your reviewers who wrote the following. This book brings the reader into the world of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, or Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, where nothing makes sense, things are absurd, timeless, and confused. And yet one can understand. The book is a journey through the labyrinth of the dream world and the mind of the narrator and her characters. Really beautifully put. Start us off. Tell us about Memento, how it first came to your mind, what led you to create it in the fashion in which you did, what you hoped the reader to learn from it, and the title. And then we will take excerpts to flesh it out for the listener.
Hi, Harvey. Thank you for picking up our conversation again and engaging in reading Memento and understanding, it seems to me, exactly what I wanted to do. It is, for me, another, I would say, portrait of the mind at work. How did I come to it? First, something about the structure. I remember a very mundane moment. I was driving to a grocery store where I usually buy my groceries, and I arrive at the grocery store, and all of a sudden I realize I had no idea how I had come there. And the reason for it was, in my mind, I was just elsewhere. The autopilot drove me there, and I would have probably noticed if something unusual would have happened. But what I found most interesting was how much our mind can transport us to any place in the world and to any moment in time. And so I think this is something that happens certainly on the couch when free association works, but it happens everywhere throughout the day, that we have these brief moments where we think of this or that, or have imagined this or that, remember something. It is sort of the ongoing dream that the Bjornians emphasize, the neo-Bjornians with waking dream thoughts that usually are thought to be unconscious. So there are also unconscious parts of it, but that the mind has the capacity and the creativity to move continuously to different places and create new ideas and images. That was something that totally fascinated me. And that is what the structure of Memento wants to portray. There are only vignettes, brief moments, and some carry the story forward. Others are kind of inserted moments that kind of come to mind to the protagonist. In brief, it's a story of the main character, Sine. I call her Sine as a short version of Gesine, but also Sine is the Latin word for without, conditio sine qua non, without, basically. So Sina, the main character, has recently lost her mother, who passed away, and she accompanies her husband, who is a researcher, to a scientific conference. And so there are these two threads throughout the novel. The one is, the main thread is the story of Sina, who mourns her mother, or basically thinks about her mother. We all know that Freud, in this famous paper, Mourning and Melancholia, wrote that after a loved one passed away, every moment or many moments that relate to this lost object have to be reinvested, and then the libido is withdrawn, and that has to continue in a painful process over and over till the mourning process is done. What Freud may have missed here or not written about is that the investment in the lost object is a much more reconstructive and integrative process, where we, for instance, remember all the stories that we have heard from the lost object, the repetitive stories, for instance, about the childhood of the person or how they met their significant others, etc. And all these stories are within us and are revived, and we have questions. We think, too bad, I never asked about this or that. And in activating these memories, we also experience joy, and we have a slow process of integration, which is not necessarily so much about loss, but about how continues this person to live in our minds. And that is a little bit the focus of this novel. It's in that sense a portrait of the mind and the process of mourning. And I think in this twilight zone of loss and mourning, the memory fuses with fantasy and daydreams, and the past becomes the present again. So the memories come back to you, and you relive them in the present in a similar way as I lived someplace while I was driving to the grocery store. So this is one part of the novel, the mourning of a person, a close person like a parent, that was lost. But mourning is also a process of that is required when we realize that an idea that was dear to us or a project that we pursued cannot be accomplished or failed. and when we have to mourn what is not possible. And that's a little bit more the story of Sina's partner, Sam, who is an inventor and goes to the scientific conference in order to present his research results and has to struggle with what academia always brings, rivalry and the fear of being dismissed or not being placed in the desired position. All these everyday life situations that come into play when one pursues a certain project that require measures of adaptations. You can despair if you don't reach something, which can even reach to suicide. But you can also perseverate, holding on to. You can acknowledge that you need to change your strategies. All of these issues are different ways of mourning the original fantasy or idea that quality prevails. I only have to invent this wonderful device, for instance, the monitor in the book, and then everybody will be ooh and ah. It's not that easy. So there are two different mourning processes that I try to describe in this book or bring to life with different stories, fantasies, dreams, and scenes, basically.
You know, you add so much to our thinking. When people lose a loved one, the commonplace and authentic, but nevertheless commonplace gesture we make to the person is that, oh, well, the person will always be with you. But you take that, of course, much further by energizing that, by not making it a passive process, oh, the person will be with you, but that there's an active investment in that person. And it's a creation within you for the rest of your life. And then you take it further and you say, yes, that's true when you suffer a death of someone close to you, but also when you have an idea, a concept, something that you value that turns not to fruition. And there has to be a giving up of that. And you and the book and Sam and his travails come very much alive. And how he struggles with that and how his partner helps him struggle with that. It's a beautiful, you say it, it's a poetry of the mind and the process of mourning. You couldn't describe it better. How about if you read some sections for us to give the listener a feel for who the characters are and how you paint the characters?
Okay, I love to do that. So I may start with a vignette about Sina's mother, and you will hear in what ways she appears on the mind of the Sina. At night, Marlene, this is the mother's name is Marlene. At night, Marlene played hide and seek with her thoughts. There was someone she would follow. She would find him in a different country. Who knew? At night, Marlene came into my room, dressed in her chemise, a ghost, like a ghost. Silently, she moved only to check on her daughter. Was she sleeping? She sat for a while on the small mattress right next to my feet and stroked the comforter as if in displacement. The alarm clock second hand softly throbbed. Tack, 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 tack. So calming, a rhythm hypnotic and suggestive, pulling in her in and over to these strange places of yore. There she rose and started to dance, all alone, yet as if in front of stunned eyes. She lifted the veil of her nightgown that lagged behind her at every turn and threatened to wrap around her like a noose. Her big back, bare feet palpitated the floorboards in search of a safe place to stay. None was ever found. Her legs, tight and strong, wouldn't rest. They seemed to float through the moonlight, as did her bare arms, rising and falling like a penguin's wings. Was she happy or desperate? Was she acting in a trance or secretly crazy? It happened, it always happened, that her nightie dropped, if not on purpose, slipped off her shoulders to the one or the other side, got hung up for a moment at her full breasts before the whole curtain skidded down and crumbled around her feet. But the music in her head never stopped. Her beautiful hands lifted her hair up over her head, and freed from all restraint, she now danced, cooing, with closed eyes and a luscious smile, all longing, wailing, hoo-hoo, you-you, hoo-hoo. Through the grate of my lashes, I saw the ugly scar that slashed her back from her right buttock to her left shoulder.
You know, I have to share with you, I have read that, though it is a very different experience to have it read to you. It's more musical to hear it read. There's a poetry, and it's easier to go with the ethereal quality of it, for me anyway, than reading it, because for me, reading it brings with it, for better and worse, like, how do I understand this? And what is this saying? But listening to you, it's more of the melody that that deepens. And I also noticed that I had a smile on my face as I was listening to it. So
it's interesting that you say this, because some readers told me they were all the time wondering, where does that belong or where does that go? Sort of the ego wanted to orient itself.
Exactly, right.
But as analysts, on the other hand, we are a bit more used to not know and just to let us drift in the associations, right?
Sure. Though that does come more easily to analysts when we listen. That's what we do.
Right.
Reading may be common for me and for others. Reading, like, what is this? And
yes.
Again, poetry is the best example, because we don't do that in poetry. We don't tighten up for linear meaning in poetry. And
yeah. Maybe I should have made a subtitle, a novel for analysts.
No, you don't want to narrow your audience. I like the poetry of the mind myself, but
yeah. Here in this piece that I just read, one can probably easily see that it has this quality. Is this a dream of Sina? Did she dream this? Or is this fantasy about her mother and about her mother's sexuality? What's going on there? And when I ended this scene, this idea came into my mind about this ugly scar that slashed her back from the right buttock to the left shoulder. And I wrote it down because it came to mind. And it's pretty clear that this is not a surgical scar, which would mm-hmm. never have that shape across the back. And then I remembered the pictures of Marilyn Monroe where they are crossed out. And I thought, in some ways, this idea of this strange scar at the back brings something to mind of the sexuality of the mother, of also this admired and envied lusciousness of her, and that it needs to be crossed out, but it's only crossed out half of it, basically. So I thought I let it be.
Well, let me ask you, I've read some of your other novels, and this is different. Did you have confidence that you could bring the dream experience into your writing? I mean, because it is a different type of writing.
It's what interests me most, You know, this is what made me write this novel. That's what I love most, if I can get there, which, of course, there needs to be also a story, and the story is the arrival at the conference hotel, the castle,
right.
The departure at the end. So there is a more seemingly realistic frame, even though the castle could also be the place of mourning. One can take it as one wants to. But this is what I like best in writing, more than just telling a story. And in Memory's Eyes, I tried it a little bit too, but there was the structure of the three Sophocles plays. So the whole thing had also a much more reality-oriented ring for me. It was saying something about the Oedipus complex and that it is not gone by, but still active everywhere. But here I felt most free, actually, to just stick with it and see where it goes.
It reminds me of conversations I've had with analysts, artists, who speak of representational artwork and abstract artwork, and how they each call upon different parts of themselves.
Yeah.
Why don't you introduce us to Sam?
Yeah, Sam is a scientist, a neuroscientist, who has developed a device. At some point in the novel, it's called a kind of mind reader. What can this device read? Only the conscious or also the unconscious parts and what have you. It remains a little bit unclear what the monitor is. That is to say, Sina doesn't really know what it is and is also curious about it. And he wants to present it at this conference. And to develop it, it was a difficult time. And I read a vignette just how he worked on it. And that goes like this. No, Sam had no plan and nowhere to go. Disheartened and spent, he withdrew into his shell of silence. This was after a setback. I saw him sitting with his hands over his head, cautiously groping as if in search of an idea. At night, he blew smoke at his laptop. In the morning, I found him asleep in his office chair. My touch would startle him. What? What? Impatiently, he yelled at me and then apologized. I pretended not to notice that he wasn't working. Or was he? He used up stack of print paper and ordered more. I wanted to help. He wouldn't let me. The months went by. Sometimes my thoughts flew with the sun to the sea and the beach and the soft hills of Tuscany, but my heart anxiously stuck at home with my man unmoored, waiting for a move, a resolve, a breakthrough. And then, one morning, when I came into the kitchen, Sam was sitting at the table, a cup of coffee in front of him, and his face was as clear as ever. I found the algorithm, he said. I solved the problem. And I was so exhausted, I could only cry. So that is a bit about the obsession of Sam working on his device and suffering when it didn't work. And when he comes to present this device at the scientific conference, he is confronted with his rival, whose name I coined Peacock. Peacock is his rival, who seems to steal from his invention and tries to marginalize him. And after such an encounter, there's another brief vignette that may fit here. Sam is lying on our bed and tries to calm down, but he is so upset that he twists and turns and pounds the pillow with his fists and kicks the comforter at his feet. I've seen him like this before. It's like a thunderstorm, short and fierce. When his anger has blown over, calm sets in, and for a while he seems resigned or depressed. Then he returns to his research, clear, balanced, and curious, probing preliminary formulations, challenging, rejecting, and reconnecting them to the one question he has in mind until he finds a solution. This is who he is. He lifts the veil, he moves the pebbles, never is he far behind the light on his way. And I let him be. Sam has fallen asleep. His eyes move rapidly. He's dreaming. Maybe he's fighting peacock, or he's developing his monitor. And I can sit next to him and relax.
The existence of this mysterious monitor is one of those delightful, frustrating, and humorous themes throughout the book. You're laughing as I say it. Tell us about each of our reactions to it.
Yeah, I have been asked various times, what is this monitor? And so I don't want to answer, and I even can't answer. Right. I can perhaps give a hint, as I do at the beginning of the novel, when the monitor comes into play first. I say that it looks like an apple or a hand grenade. And obviously, I was thinking of the Apple computer that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And the hand grenade is also, what does this technology do with us, or eventually do in the world? But I can't and don't want to say much more about it. It's nice to ponder on it.
Good. There are many other appearances that people make in the book, and we don't have time to go into all of them. I invite the reader to taste this. It's really quite a delicious meal. But I do want to bring up the one you introduce, of all things, an analyst.
Yes.
And why don't you read a little piece of that, and just to give the audience a sense of it, and then we should move on to some of the clinical work you also want to talk about.
Okay. So this episode goes like this. I go to see my analyst. I say, I told you what happened, all these facts, but facts won't change. What else is there? What do I imagine? For instance, you. I don't want you to be a fact. I want to look at you and find you looking with me at things I cannot look at by myself. Tell me what you see. Tell me. My analyst sways his heavy head. But you are here and I am here, he claims. I know, I say. But that's not what this is about. I'm stuck. I've lost my zest. I've given up. My analyst looks at me, his hand playing with his iPhone. You are depressed, he claims. I don't think so, I protest. No, it's something else. I have all these thoughts, and I want to play with them, with you. My analyst purses his lips. To play requires acknowledging the basic facts. The basic facts? What is he suggesting? I'm not at war with basic facts. I feel discouraged, bored. Then I kick myself and try again. Can't you just listen to what I come up with, picture it, and tell me what you see? My analyst doesn't respond. His head is sunken down. His chin rests on his chest. His shirt is white. He's sleeping. Through his loosened fingers, his iPhone has slipped down into the chair's cushions. An iPhone, the newest edition. His linen pants are bulky, nicely rumpled, and right down at the bottom, where his white sneakers blink twice, they snuggle casually around his big feet, touching the woolen carpet at his heels. He sailed off. I'm stunned. He fell asleep on me. I'm wide awake. Quietly, I lift myself out of my chair across from his, my eyes firmly fixated on the sleeping colossus. I've made up my mind. I tiptoe around the coffee table. I've always wanted to do this. I feel a spark of joy tickling inside. I hold my breath. My hand on the doorknob slowly moves. No sound to be heard. I'll make it, I think. I inch it open, still looking at him, slowly, steadily. But then, just as my foot crosses the doorstep into the hallway, my analyst's dog, a Newfoundlander that had patiently waited for the end of the session, jumps up, barking and wagging its tail. This friendly creature, all excited, runs past me through the open door, barking to reach his master in his chair. Now he realized that I wanted to sneak out, I think, startled, embarrassed, still hesitant. The dog barks, pushes his snout into his master's lap, barks and pushes, barks. His master doesn't move. He doesn't wake up.
I'm quiet in the face of that. It just sits there. It doesn't have a big context in the story. It's a beautiful piece of writing. It is something many of us have imagined in various iterations. You capture at the beginning of the segment so nicely the literalness versus the play that is so often a struggle in the analytic space. Do we deal with facts? Do we let facts go? They are important and they're not important. So I'm going to leave it by just saying congratulations on that. That's beautifully written. And
well, let me say one thing to it.
Okay.
Besides, as you mentioned, this is what many of us and of our patients have imagined when the analyst is silent. Did he fall asleep? Did she die on me? Right. In particular, when one is older. But another element I also wanted to just touch briefly on it. It's not depression. Mourning is not depression, and it can go along with all these sparks of ideas. So to distinguish that, I think, is also important.
Oh, and let's underline that, because just as a digression, when people are trained only to understand withdrawal of mood and excitement as an indication for medication, then they, of course, can't make the distinction, which is not to say that there aren't circumstances where depression is severe and needs to be addressed as such. But unless you have familiarity and expertise working in both arenas, it is easy to conflate those two. So your point is an important one. Let's shift gears. I would love to stay in the book, but there's more we need to say. Let's talk about clinical work. And I want to read a few sentences that you wrote me about it. And you wrote, "In my analytic work with patients, I try to understand their mind at work, namely to uncover and develop the storylines that write their lives, their unconscious organizing fantasies like infantile neurotic beliefs, a deep-seated grudge, a secret project that shape their experiences, determine their life trajectories, and limit their inner and outer freedom." Now, you add something to our literature, and this, again, is touching on your clinical work and on your theoretical work. You are a student of Freud, and you are such a good student that you don't mind making corrections when you think it's useful. And you have introduced a concept that you call lethe. And I turned to the dictionary, and it says, "In Greek mythology, Lethe is a river in the underworld of Hades that causes people to forget their past if they drink from it." And in your book, the theoretical book, you write, "Lethe is a term both analogous and equivalent to libido. The fact that the term lethe means forgetfulness, repression, is consistent with our constant emphasis on the inward direction of the drive toward the unconscious. The term lethe, through the image of a river, evokes the idea of a flow of energy directed by the drive. And since the river lethe flows from the world of the living to that of the dead, The name Lethe also takes into account the ultimate aim of Freud's postulated death drive. You go on to say that Lethe is used in everyday language in precisely our sense. We call someone's behavior lethargic, and we speak of lethargy, of a deleterious condition, and of a lethal dose of a particular drug. Introduce us to Lethe, and then let's talk about some fictionalized clinical material that you have that will bring it to light.
Yeah, very briefly, Freud's metapsychology is based upon the general assumption that the mind has the tendency to perpetuate a state of dynamic stability or homeostasis. The mind is like any other living system. So the question is, how can the mind do that? And the answer is with the help of two antagonistic drives. And we had the sexual and the self-preservative drives in Freud's early theory and later the life and the death drives. And we all know that the energy of the sexual and the life drives is libido, means desire or lust. Libido is associated with something exciting. And in Freud's later turn, with the death drive, he introduced aggression as the antagonist. But aggression is also exciting. And if you have, if you activate libido and aggression together, you cannot balance the system. So what was missing, I think, was a calming force in his theory, in the dynamic of drive activity. And he tried to go there a little bit with the death drive when he said the death drive is mute and does its work quietly. But then he didn't find a way to conceptualize that. And this is what I basically add to the theory, or it's my revision of his drive theory, that the death drive and also the somewhat lost self and object preservative drives operate with a calming energy. And I called this Lethe because it's a river in the realm of the dead, and it's about forgetting. So the whole idea of repression is served with it. And if you think of a portion of libidinal excitement and a portion of calming libido, then you are basically on a balanced level. This is how the mind balances itself out when it is overexcited to the one or to the other side. So Freud's idea was sexuality and aggression are the two primal drives, and this is what we are stuck with for 100 years now. And I say, no, it's sex and care. It is about caretaking and soothing that is necessary in order to be balanced. And aggression is basically the enhancement of either of those. You can be aggressively sexual or aggressively preservative, the overpowering, protective, overprotective object basically is in an aggressive way taking care of the other.
Now, let me ask you about that, because it is commonplace to hear in case discussions that the analysands are understood as having problems with their aggression.
Yeah.
With the presumption that it would be in their interest and the analyst's task to help them become aware of and comfortable with their aggression. Do you want to put that through your prism and tell us a better way to think about it?
Absolutely. This is totally right. You hear in case presentation when it's, for instance, about sexuality, the analyst says, but what about his aggression? That is something here. As if aggression were a thing in itself. As if aggression needs to be acknowledged and tamed, and then the thing would be done. But the question is, what is this? Why did this aggression come up? Aggression is about something, an idea that has been thwarted, a fear that comes up. It can be a fear of being ridiculed as a lover, or to be diminished in one's narcissistic investment. It can also be in terms of one's safety, that one feels endangered, or one feels the object one cares about are endangered, and then one becomes aggressive, aggressively defending what is primal and what is important, which means safety or survival and sexuality in the broadest sense. So in that sense, I think what is missing in this idea that aggression is a thing in itself is to wonder what this aggression wants to assert. I think it would be much better in psychoanalysis if we would talk about asserting oneself. The aggressive expression wants to assert a certain goal, and the goal needs to be analyzed, or the fantasy that stirs up this goal.
Now, you don't simply mean, I take it, that aggression is a defense against hurt and vulnerability, though it can be that, but you're meaning something different.
This is part of it. It can be a defense against hurt, but it can also be a forceful pursuit of one's goals. So I want this person to do that for me, and this person doesn't do anything, so I hammer it at the person. So what aggression basically only says to us is there is an enhancement, an enforcement of something, and we need to understand what this something is. An analysant that is aggressive towards the analyst tells the analyst, there is something you didn't understand, or there is something you said that is maybe true, but it hurts me and I don't want to hear it. It diminishes me, or the like. So what is it that leads to this enforcement of the drive's expression?
Let's talk cases. You've compiled a few examples. Again, these are not real people, but composites and fictionalized summaries, to give us a sense of how the theory lives and works in your hands.
Yeah. Let me first very briefly characterize how I distinguish libido and lethe. Libidinal activity, I think, shows in alertness, lust, love, liveliness, warmth, joy. It is usually light and bright and colorful and mobile. And in the extreme, it can be manic. And lethic activity, by contrast, has a trend towards oblivion, darkness, silence, fatigue, a preoccupation with sorrow, grief, worry, disease. It slows down, it feels empty, it feels cold. And in the extreme, it may reach to depression and catatonic stupor. That may sound surprising. I've worked with a patient for many years, and she basically suffered from this ongoing lethic pull towards doubting herself, or feeling discouraged, sad, etc. So we worked for a long time, and the history that caused her a tendency towards these lethic behaviors. And eventually it was worked through. Eventually she felt so much better, and she said, I'm basically happy. She was amazed how that went on. And then she came in one day, and she said, do you have a new couch? And I said, no. And she said, well, but wasn't your couch always black? I see it is green. And she, it may be such a tiny thing, but I was stunned because I thought, yeah, she saw my couch as black, as her whole look into the world had always a little bit a darkened shadow over it. Even though I thought, in by nature, she wasn't depressive, she wasn't lethic. She had a very active side to herself that was continuous under the shadow. So even when you think that a couch that looked black all of a sudden can be seen as green, which is the color of my couch, that I think is quite stunning.
Yeah, you and I are both smiling as you relate the story. It's lovely, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, let me put it that way. Patients who are functioning under the predominance of a lethic drive activity often come in and they are so tired, they are exhausted, they complain, they can be hypochondriacally concerned. They see sort of everything a little black. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on and on. I think they lack a well-structured sense for how to make sure that they are healthy and well in life and that their objects are healthy and well in life. So the preservative, self-preservative ideas, let's say, are underdeveloped. And it takes a while to help them see that they are continuously concerned, basically in the extreme, to not survive. They are continuously threatened that something bad could happen. And this preoccupation resides in an unconscious organizing fantasy of I will always be threatened. I will always see my objects can become sick and die, perhaps. And that's what they are continuously working on. In their it colors basically their experience of their lives. And then there are some people, as in fact Sophocles describes with Oedipus, if one reads it that way. Oedipus was someone who of course had done grave injustice by having sex with his mother and producing children with her. He is after having been the most outrageous in sexuality, he becomes now the biggest in pain. He becomes the biggest in suffering. He is even blind. He cannot see anymore. He needs to be guided through the world by his daughter. So Oedipus is someone who almost prides himself as being the biggest in pain. And that is also a tendency. I have called it the lethic phallus in contrast to the libidinal phallus that is colorful and mighty. It's the potency of suffering, basically, that is celebrated there.
Why don't you develop that? It's a perfect segue. You have two brief vignettes that demonstrate what you call the lethic phallus and the libidinal phallus. Why don't you just share them with us just to develop that thought further?
Well, the lethic phallus I could associate with a fictional patient, Bill, who is always exhausted, who has to do all the work. He has to earn all the monies that his siblings spend. And he, time and again, he comes and complains that they are so irresponsible. He has worked so hard to help them out. They just gamble and spend the money, etc. And then on top of all, he doesn't feel sufficiently praised or acknowledged in his responsibility, in his generosity, and that he is the only one who is responsible in his family. And he cannot even have date a woman because he has no time for it. He has to first make sure that all his siblings are taken care of. So there is this hidden pride. I can do all of this, and I am sort of not in a grandiose way. I'm the rescuer of everybody in my family. That is hard to break down and to make him aware that he draws satisfaction from it, and to revive basically the little sparks of libidinal interest that can come up when he says, for instance, I came by a clothing store and I saw this nice sweater and I thought, oh, that would look nice on me. And then immediately says, well, but I have no money. I have to first save money for paying the bill of my irresponsible brother. So to hold on to these little sparks of libidinal energy that can come up and pointing out his overemphasis of taking care of others very slowly may help to move this person from a more lethic dominated to a more libidinal stance.
Would it be fair to say or useful to consider that at those moments when he's able to experience pleasure of the usual sort of, oh, I like that sweater, and then there's a shift. There's a shift to, uh-oh, I shouldn't do that. I need to do X, Y, and Z. That it's the moment of shifting that contains the meaning, the fantasy, the risk for him if he would stay with that positive, pleasurable feeling. Does that match right up with what you're saying?
Yes. And I think what you may hint on here is that his fantasy of having to rescue his family can also be a reaction formation to his wish to just let it rip, basically. Yeah. And so to analyze that, I think, is the nitty-gritty work that we have to do. And his lethic activity and dominance can even be felt as aggressive, again, when it is too much. People say, leave me alone. I do this on my own here. So in that sense, I think it is always about the underlying fantasy or idea. By the way, speaking of ideas, I was very pleased when I, in a previous podcast, I think you did with Eike Hinze, you told us how you came to psychoanalysis. And you said that one of your teachers early on said, picture someone is reaching at something at the top of the closet. And depending on what one thinks one is going to find will change the experience of what one is going to do. This is the idea. I have the idea on the closet is perhaps a cat that will bite me. I will approach the task very differently from there is everything that I want to, and it will easily come down, right? And so these ideas that we have, I think, are so powerful. And by the way, one of the most sticking ideas in psychoanalysis is that aggression is a drive.
Right.
And it is not, I say. But this sticks in our head. And even colleagues and friends of mine who know me for years and know my work for years, one of them recently said to me, only now I understand what you want to say, because it is so difficult to let go of one idea and to open up of another. idea. So that's, by the way, the preservative, the lethic trend to hold on to what we have once established. We have thought that this is how it should be, and that's now how it should be.
Cordelia, like many paragraphs of yours, they're very rich. Let me just respond to what you said about the interview I did with Ike Hensi, which was a wonderful conversation about his understanding of the riches, the adventure was his word, of psychoanalytic training. And he asked me about my origin story, and a very brief example I gave was when I was in college, and I saw a general psychology book, and it showed a picture that still lives in my mind to this moment. And the person is reaching up to the top of the closet, and the caption said, depending upon what that person thinks is there is what determines how his body and mind will encounter grabbing it. And that play in the mind is what captured my mind and also stayed with you. So thank you for that reference. About the adhesiveness of the model of aggression, you have said that, in contradistinction to that, you have said aggression is always about something. And I think your wish to correct, amend our thinking, if not Freud's thinking, is that it isn't an end in and of itself. It's the beginning of the story. We need to understand the context and meaning, if not history, of this aggressive feeling at this very moment. And that can never be a bad thing, to always want to understand more.
Right, right. If we point out or let the patient own his aggression, as it usually is phrased, mm-hmm. That makes the patient a little bit angry, or he feels he shouldn't do this. He shouldn't have been so aggressive, but it doesn't really help to understand.
Exactly. Yes.
And so that's what analysts should be concerned with.
Well, in the spirit of understanding more, let's take our last few moments, Cordelia, and understand you a bit more. You've captured a bit of my backstory. Share with us, how are you where you are today? And that can be, you could respond as broadly and as with as much history or as you care to. But what brings you to, you have these remarkable talents and interests. You can communicate with large numbers of people. And again, I go back to the IPA and culture, where you've edited books and you've headed programs and you send out these vignettes to the IPA members every month. You are a presence in our field, and that takes a lot of libidinal energy. Give us a sample of your story, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Let me tell you perhaps something that I realized has to do with my work on metapsychology. The original book was 500 pages, and I basically dissected and analyzed every little move that Freud did in developing his theory, and then it was pared down for the English, for the first edition, and I just have edited the book again and pared it down still more. And I do this because I realized it was too much. So what is this that I want to analyze again and again and again till the last minute corner of this theory? And there's a little story that I can tell you. When I was more or less an Oedipal child, I wanted to engage my father. My father was an avid reader. He liked to read newspapers and books and so on. So he's sitting there reading, and I come up with something and say, look, I have found this, I have thought about this. And my father looks at me and said, is this really correct? Check it out again. Is it really, really, have you make sure that it's all correct? And off I went to check it again and again and control it in the hope that he might be interested. Now, I totally see that my father wanted to continue to read and sent me off. But I think that has something to do with my being such a stickler, perhaps, for the minute ideas. But my father also always encouraged me at the same time and took pleasure in my inventions and fantasies. And so I have basically... I would say a more or less sound Oedipal story that Freud even confirmed in his infantile sexual theory essay, where he says the Oedipus is the birth hour of the future scientist. And so I think I do much of my work with much libido and the nice wrinkle and the funny wrinkle that I only recently thought about when I was cutting down my metapsychology book was that I thought, it doesn't work. One cannot get the Oedipal object, and one shouldn't get the Oedipal object. So the idea that if I prove the last little wrinkle in his theory, that would get the Oedipal object. No, it's enough basically to outline the basic ideas. And I think that's what I did in this book. And that's also why I wanted to re-edit it, because I think it is very useful. And candidates who have read it feel an enormous relief, not only in reading Freud in his different states, but also other literature. It gives you a good foundation, I think. And so I think I owe this in part to my father.
You know, you teach us in your stories and by example a lesson we need continually to learn, no matter what our age, and that is certain things are not possible.
Yeah.
And it is relentlessly painful. I mean, it may soften over time, it may not soften over time, but it is always with us, and it's not a bad thing, as you point out, because it energizes our life. And as you point out with the lethic drive, it is also a caretaking drive. And you mentioned candidates, and the passing on of knowledge is also a sublimation of those wishes, and the generative spirit that you can and you have developed over the years in your writing and in your teaching, and count me as one of the people who continue to learn from you, Cordelia.
Thank you. Let me add a brief correction. It's not only relentlessly painful, but it's also relentlessly challenging and joyous. We have still something more to do. So,
well said. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Thank you for your work, for spending your time, and I look forward to your next novel.
Thank you, Harvey, for this wonderful conversation. It's very delightful. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.